From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember Academy Award-winning film composer John Barry. He died Sunday at the age of 77. Barry wrote the scores for 11 James Bond films, including From Russia with Love, Thunderball, and Goldfinger.
Very pretentious, you know, but that was the fun of it. You know, and as Fred Astaire said, give it size, give it style, and give it class. Hopefully that's what we did. We just made everything larger than life, and we made it a lot of fun.
Also, the people behind Pixar's Toy Story 3, director Lee Unkrich and screenwriter Michael Arndt, discussed their inspiration for the final Toy Story film, which was just nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new sex comedy Kaboom. But don't go in. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. John Barry, the composer famous for his work on the James Bond films, died Sunday at age 77. As a tribute, we'll revisit an interview Terry conducted with him in 1993. John Barry scored about 100 films and won Oscars for his music for Midnight Cowboy, The Lion in Winter, Born Free, and Out of Africa. But he's most known for his work on the movies of British spy 007. He orchestrated, but did not compose, the famous James Bond theme song, but did compose the scores to 11 James Bond themes and the music for such famous hit movie themes as John Barry's personal favorite, Goldfinger. When Terry Gross spoke to John Barry, he told her what influenced his arrangement of the iconic James Bond theme music.
The James Bond theme is a peculiar mixture of that low rock guitar figure, if you like, and the brass sound of like the Kenton Band, and then the bridge that do-da-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da. It's almost like a Dizzy Gillespie bebop phrase, you know. So it was this kind of hybrid of all these kind of things that I was involved with at the time. And I must say, I didn't give it too much thought, and it just came out like it did, you know. I didn't sit down and intellectualize about it, and I've never read a James Bond book. I'd only seen like a cartoon strip that they used to have in the Daily Mail in England. So I knew it was about a spy. I knew roughly what the essence was, but I never saw the movie. I just wrote the damn thing, you know.
Well, I love this music, so we have to right now hear the James Bond theme. This is the John Barry Orchestra. It's an odd chord at the end, isn't it? That chord that hangs suspended.
Yeah, well,
there.
It was laid on fourth, and then that. Yeah. I mean, it's such a concoction. It's like when you start making a soup and you don't know really where you're going, but you make it, and in the end, it kind of tastes okay, you know?
Well, I used to love seeing the openings of the movies, you know, in the Sean Connery days when the series was new. And, you know, the music would start, and then Sean Connery would walk onto the screen and then turn around and pull out his gun as the music swelled behind
right.
him. That was so
right.
exciting. What did you think the first time you saw the music with the whole James Bond, you know, with the whole Sean Connery thing in it?
Well, when I wrote the theme, I was given a timing. I wasn't given any action sequence. I didn't know what they looked like or whatever. And it was like the movie was in release in 3 weeks' time. It was what we call a wet print when it went into the theatres because it was so behind. And then it opened at the Pavilion in Piccadilly in London, and I went on a Sunday afternoon and saw it, and that was the first time I'd ever seen Dr. No. And I understood that I was just writing the main title theme. But then every time he says, I'm Bond, James Bond, and it laid it in all over the damn place. And it worked, you know. I mean, with film, there's no middle ground, you know. It either works or it doesn't. There's no, well, it works a little. I mean, a good score is a score that really works 100%, where you just hit all the buttons.
Now, you not only did the scores for, you know, 11 James Bond films, you wrote the title songs for the films. I want to play one of those title songs. This is Goldfinger, sung by Shirley Bassey.
A cold finger beckons you to enter his web of sin. But don't go in. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you feel. Kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger.
That's Shirley Bassey singing the theme from Goldfinger, the song and the score written by my guest, John Barry. Were you told, make this theme sexually insinuating?
No, they really left you alone. They really just, they said, go away and write it. So I never discussed with the director or the producers. I discussed it with myself, and I thought, well, what is this about? It's a song about a villain. And then I started to reflect historically, well, there's no songs about villains. You don't, you know, people don't sit down and write songs about villains. They write love songs, they write sad songs, they write torch songs, whatever. But songs about villains are very rare. And then I thought of Kurt Weill's Mack the Knife, which is the definitive song about a villain. So then I got my head on right, and I sat down and wrote this rather strange melody just based on the word Goldfinger as the opening line. And then I thought, well, who can write a lyric to this? So Anthony Newley and Leslie Bricus had also just got a huge theatrical success in England called Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. And I knew Tony very well, and I phoned him up and I said, look, I've written this song, I've written the melody, but I haven't got the song. I'd like to meet with you. I went out to his home in Hampstead, played him it, and he said, well, what the hell's it all about? And I said, it's Mack the Knife. It's a song about the villain. And he said, got it. Then I'd worked with Shirley in concerts, and she was very big in England at that time. And Shirley has this one thing. She has such conviction about what she does. So I played her the song, and she said, well, what the hell is this about? It's about a villain, Shirley. I said, don't think too much about it, Shirley. Just go into the studio and convince the world that you know what you're doing, and you can do that, because I've worked with you in the theatre, and you do this better than anybody else I know. We then went in and recorded it, and originally it just started off with the chords, dee-dum, and there was no bar, yeah, that wasn't there then. And we had a break, they went up for their 10-minute tea break, and in the tea break, I just found it that what we were playing, that was empty, so I sat down at the piano and I came up with a da-ya-na-na-dan, and did it on Wow Wow trumpets, and we put that in, which just kind of brought it to life, and then we repeated it down the line. When Harry Saltzman heard it, he was one of the producers. Harry, I can't tell you what he said.
He hated it, huh?
He said, that is the worst song I have ever heard in my life. But we're stuck with it because we don't have any time and the movie's coming out. And Guy Hamilton, who was the director, was, you know, he was in the Air Force. He was one of the few who fought the Battle of Britain, and he's very proper and very splendid man. He said, well, I don't know whether it's going to be a hit or not, Harry, but I know dramatically it works for the movie. And Cubby Broccoli said, I like it. Let's do it.
Did the success of Goldfinger make it obligatory to have a theme with lyrics for each of the subsequent James Bond films?
Well, why I always demanded writing the music first was that when you see the whole of the movie of Goldfinger, the theme runs throughout the movie, even the whole Fort Knox sequence at the end. The main da-ya-da. I mean, I don't like a song stuck on the beginning of a movie because it's just a song, and then it has nothing to do with the rest of the movie, which is what happens today. All the Bond songs I integrated completely into the score, from You Only Live Twice, Thunderball, Diamonds Forever. They were the main title song, but they were also the genesis of the rest of the score.
There's something about your Goldfinger scores songs that remind me a little bit of the Frankie Lane movie themes, those big Western anthems that he used to sing.
Well, it's kind of, you know, I did one or two interviews with the English press at the time, and they said, well, what is it? And I said, it's Million Dollar Mickey Mouse music. Because it's, and it's Wagnerian. I mean, the whole opening of Goldfinger is like this very pretentious, you know, I mean, it's, but that was the fun of it. You know, and as Fred Astaire said, give it size, give it style, and give it class. And that's like an incredible Bible to follow. And hopefully that's what we did. We just made everything larger than life, and we made it a lot of fun. So everybody went in. They knew he was going to be, he'd get the broad, he'd kill the villain, he'd be happy. And that was the formula, and we enjoyed it on that level.
Composer John Barry speaking to Terry Gross in 1993. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1993 interview with composer John Barry, who died Sunday at age 77. He wrote the film scores for 11 James Bond films and won Oscars for his music for such films as The Lion in Winter and Dances with Wolves.
There's one more James Bond song that I have to get in here, and that's Thunderball, the theme from Thunderball sung by Tom Jones. I think this is just a particularly fun one also.
Well, there's a kind of fascinating story behind that, because that is probably the worst title for a song you can imagine.
Oh, exactly. I mean,
you know, and I spoke to Tony Newley about it, actually, and he says, what do we do? Thunderball, marvelous, you should care for me. Thunderball. So I said, that's not going to work. I think somebody already did that. So it was such an abstract title. So they were shooting down in Nassau. Not Nassau County, you know, the island. They were doing all that stuff down there. And I flew down there, and on the way down, I was reading a magazine, and it said that the Italians had a name for James Bond now, which was Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which I thought was really terrific. So I thought, instead of using the word Thunderball, why don't we write a song called Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang? Cubby absolutely loved it. Harry loved it. Everybody fell in love with it. So I recorded. I recorded with Dionne Warwick. We recorded with Shirley. And then the powers that be at United Artists in New York, literally 2 weeks before the movie opened, phoned him and said, you know, we need that Goldfinger thing. We need that title over the radio. And Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang isn't doing it. We need Thunderball. So I called up Don Black and I said, look, we've got to do this in like no time whatsoever. So I said, what does it mean? And he said, I don't know what the hell it means. I really don't know what it means. So I wrote a theme that facilitated the word. Don then wrote the lyric. He then called Tom Jones. And now the whole Bond thing was being a big success. You know, you could have called anybody, you know. Everybody now wanted to do Bond songs because of the success that Shirley had had, and the whole aura that was hanging around the movies. So Tom came in, and he said the first thing when he heard it, he said, "What the hell's it about?" In his Welsh accent, "What the hell's it about?" I said, "Tom, don't ask. Just take a leaf out of Shirley's book, get in the studio, sing the hell out of it, and leave. Please, don't get into it. Just do that." And he said, "Oh, all right, okay, I'll do it." So he goes, "Hunt the boy," and it was the same. It was the same mood. Just convince everybody. And he was so convincing. I don't think anybody really analyzed what the hell he was singing about. And I still don't know what the song is about to this day. But we were given that problem, and we have to live with it.
Well, the lyricist came up with good ideas for Thunderball. They call him the winner who takes all, and he
yes,
strikes
Don
like
did.
Thunderball.
Absolutely.
A decent solution
yeah, he
to
did.
The problem.
He did actually, in the nick of time, come out with that line, which made it slightly credible, you know.
I love these lyrics. They're so funny. His days of asking are all gone. His fight goes on and on and on.
Right, right.
So you must have had fun doing this. I mean, this is just really, it's very silly and very fun.
Talk about a license to kill. It's a license right. to write silly and just have great fun. You know, I mean, that was the whole joy of these movies, that this was not Citizen Kane, you know. It was just this fun comic strip. So you could get away with murder. If this had been a one-off, some guy made a movie called Thunderball, and it hadn't had the cachet that was growing up around the whole thing, we'd have been thrown out of the studio. It was the whole thing just, we were launched. And you could do anything really silly, and that was the freedom of it. And why I left ultimately was because it stopped being wonderful and silly. It started to be formula, and that's when the fun went out of it. And once the fun goes out of it, well, there's really no point.
Well, it's time to hear Thunderball, sung by Tom Jones, music by my guest John Barry.
Runs while others walk. He acts while other men just talk. He looks at this world and wants it all. So he strikes. He knows the meaning of success. His needs are more, so he gives less. They call all, and he strikes like thunderbolt.
Talk about big arrangements. That is really great. And I like the way you managed to work in the James Bond theme underneath it. Very nice.
Every trick in the book we use, believe me, we didn't leave anything out.
Now, why are minor keys so essential in these Bond themes?
I guess minor keys are essential in my life. I love writing in minor keys. I adore them. They're just emotionally more fruitful. And there's a certain sense of tragedy. Although you're playing hokey, if you had to do James Bond in major keys, it would sound like Mickey Mouse cartoon music. It mm-hmm. really would, mm-hmm. you know. It's because you play it in the minor key that it gives it a weight and a power, you know. I mean, you know, you listen to Shostakovich, you listen to Prokofiev, I mean, it's all this minor, heavy. I'm very, very influenced. I mean, my greatest loves are the Russian composers, Shostakovich, Prokofiev, Stravinsky. The Russians have a way with the minor key that no other people have. And if anybody says, what's the biggest influence in your life, as much as I love Beethoven and a million other things, it's that Russian attitude to be able to deal with the minor key.
This is good because Bond was always fighting the Russians, so
that wasn't a part of the thing. It just happened to work out well in that.
Right.
But it gives it size. It gives it more sense of drama. If you'd have tried to score the Bond movies in major keys, when you think about it, it would have been absolutely disastrous.
John Barry speaking to Terry Gross in 1993. The Oscar-winning film composer died Sunday at age 77. Let's listen to one more Barry composition. The song they discussed, Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, the original main title theme to Thunderball. This version wasn't released until 1990. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
He's tall and he's dark, and like a shark, he looks for trouble. That's why the zero's double, Mr. Kiss Kiss. And he can soothe you like vanilla. The gentleman's a killer, Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Damoiselles in danger have filled the stranger's path. Like a knife, he cuts through life, like every day. He's from the school that loves and leaves them. A pity if it grieves them.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition. On the web at MetLife.org. And from Chevrolet, maker of the Volt. It's more car than electric. Available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. This is NPR.
Toy Story 3 is the highest-grossing animated film of all time. It's been nominated for a Best Picture Oscar. Part of the story is inspired by the time the film's director, Lee Unkrich, accidentally threw away his wife's childhood stuffed animals. Coming up, we'll talk to Unkrich and Michael Arndt, who wrote the screenplay. And David Edelstein reviews the new movie, Kaboom. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Pixar Studios' Toy Story 3 is up for 5 Oscars this year, including an Academy Award nomination for Best Picture, only the third time an animated film has been nominated in that category. And it's the highest-grossing animated film of all time, earning more than $1 billion worldwide. We're revisiting an interview Terry Gross conducted with the film's director, Lee Unkrich, and its screenwriter, Michael Arndt, last fall. Lee Unkrich has been with Pixar since 1994. He started there as a film editor on Toy Story and went on to co-direct Toy Story 2 and Monsters, Inc. Michael Arndt won an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay for his first film, Little Miss Sunshine. At the beginning of Toy Story 3, Andy is preparing to leave home for college. His mother tells him that before he goes, he has to deal with his toys. She gives him several options. He can take them to college, store them in the attic, donate them to a daycare center, or put them in the trash. The toys are terrified that after years of being played with by Andy, after years of being cared for and loved, after years of being a little toy community, they will be abandoned and tossed on a garbage truck. Woody, the wooden toy sheriff voiced by Tom Hanks, tries to reassure the toys as the toys begin to panic.
We're getting thrown away?
No, no one's getting thrown away.
How do you know?
We're being abandoned.
We'll be fine, Jesse.
So why did Sarge leave?
Should we leave?
I thought we were going to the attic.
Oh, I hate all this uncertainty.
Whoa, hold on. Now, wait a minute. Quiet. No one's getting thrown out, okay? We're all still here. I mean, yeah, we've lost friends along the way. Wheezy and Etch and...
Bo Peep?
Yeah, even Bo. All good toys who've gone on to new owners. But through every yard sale, every spring cleaning, Andy held on to us. He must care about us or we wouldn't be here.
You wait. Andy's gonna tuck us in the attic. It'll be safe and warm.
And we'll all be together.
Exactly. There's games up there and books and...
The race car track.
The race car track, thank you.
And the old TV.
There you go, the old TV. And those guys from the Christmas decorations box, they're fun, right?
Yeah.
And someday, if we're lucky, Andy may have kids of his own.
And he'll play with us then, right?
We'll always be there for him.
Come on, guys. Let's get our parts together, get ready, and go out on a high note.
It's a scene from Toy Story 3, and my guests are the director of the film, Lee Unkrich, and the writer, Michael Arndt. Welcome to Fresh Air. Although that scene is, you know, the toys worrying about being obsolete, I think it speaks to adults because I think probably a lot of parents worry about becoming irrelevant in the lives of their children after their children grow up. Older adults in the workforce worry about being replaced by younger workers. You know, a lot of older people worry about becoming obsolete in their own way. And so I'm wondering, Michael Arndt, writing the film, if you were trying to operate on two levels at the same time, speaking to emotional fears that adults have and that children have.
It's funny, when you first start writing these films, usually what you're trying to do, I mean, you just sort of have a bag full of disparate ideas and none of them quite fit together. And so your first concern when you take this over is you're just trying to make everything fit together on a basic narrative level. And the scene that you just played, which we called Growing Up, when we started writing it, was one of the hardest scenes to write because you're meeting these characters sort of again for the first time, and you have to figure out what their expectations for the future are. And I remember when we first started writing it, our thought was that, well, you know, Buzz is going to be an optimist, and he's going to hope that they go to college with Andy, and Mr. Potato Head is going to be a pessimist, and he's going to think that they're all going to get thrown out. And, you know, some other people think, well, maybe we'll go to the attic, and Woody, you know, is mature enough to say, well, I don't know what's going to happen. And the problem with that scenario, that setup, is that you end up having these endless conversations in which all the toys stand around and argue with what's about to happen. And I think I went back and counted all the drafts that we did of this scene. We did 60 different drafts. And the big breakthrough was finally deciding, okay, they all have already had this conversation before. They all have decided that they're going to get put in the attic. This is what happens to toys. This is part of the natural lifespan of toys, is that you serve, you know, your kid, you play with your kid, and then if you do a good job, you're going to get, you know, sort of rewarded with retirement and put in the attic. And it was really only after we had set up that sort of narrative structure that we started to realize how emotional it was and how much it played into people's fears of obsolescence. And I do think that it speaks to people's, not everybody, but certainly a lot of people go through life feeling as though the work they do, the job they do at work or at home with their kids is unappreciated or unacknowledged. You know, these toys feel like they've given themselves over to this child, Andy, 100%, and played with him and shared so much of his life, and now he's going away. And they don't want to go with him necessarily to college. What they really want is acknowledgement.
I think that's why part of why people feel so much emotion in that last scene is that we've created a moment where the toys are appreciated, they are loved against all odds, and they are able to have that glorious feeling one last time. And I think it speaks to something deeply in a lot of people in the audience at different points in their lives.
Michael, your first film was the screenplay for Little Miss Sunshine, and since then you've been writing for animated characters. Was it hard for you to start thinking about the interior life of toys? Like, how would You know, how would a dinosaur toy react? How would Mr. Potato Head react to a transition in his life?
You have to, as a writer, you can't make any difference in have any distinction in your head between a live-action character and an animated character. They're all real characters. I mean, to me, I feel like Buzz Lightyear is just as real as Olive Hoover is. You want to be sort of as emotionally honest and intelligent about what they're going through as you can possibly be. But it does lead to these sort of odd situations when you're a writer and suddenly you have to think, okay, I'm a little ragdoll and I've just been put into a knapsack. You know, now what do I do? Or you know, I'm Mr. Potato Head and I lose my parts. How do I feel about that? So there were times when I thought it kind of felt odd to be writing scenes like that. But you have to take it seriously. Like, you have to put yourself in that position and say, okay, what would I do if I was in that situation? And there's times you almost feel ridiculous doing that. But I think once you make that commitment, and you write the characters sort of as honestly and with as much feeling as you can, people respond to that. People feel it coming through the screen.
So the toys in Toy Story 3 end up at a daycare center. And the preschool turns into a prison for Andy's toys, and then the movie becomes like a prison escape movie. So did you sit down and watch a lot of prison films?
Yeah, we did. I mean, Michael can attest to the fact that we spent many a day watching prison escape movies all day long, every day, to the point where we felt sometimes like we were trying to break out of prison ourselves.
The one thing we learned is that there's no such thing as a short prison movie. Basically, they're all more than 2 hours long. You know, the shortest is 2 hours long.
Yeah, we saw one French film in particular. I don't know if you remember the name of it, Michael, where they literally the entire movie, you watch them chip away at concrete, and then in the final minutes of the film, they get busted. And then the movie ended.
Oh, that's the perfect stereotype of a certain type of really boring prison film where they steal the spoon from the dining room and then slowly carve away at the wall. Yeah,
exactly. And we wanted to do all that stuff. I mean, I wish we could have done more. The actual prison break section of the movie ends up being just like 20 minutes of the film. But my story artist came up with so many great gag ideas. We had one idea where they were kind of digging their way out and Mr. Potato Head would secret the dirt away inside his butt and then kind of walk over to the corner and open his butt and dump the dirt out. And I mean, it's just like we wanted to have as many of these kind of great little prison cliches as possible. That's where the character of the chatter telephone came from, the Fisher-Price chatter telephone. Every one of these prison movies has some old guy who's been in there for life, and he totally knows the lay of the land, and he knows his way around, and somehow travels under the radar. And we knew we had to have a character like that, and we made this decision to have it be that Fisher-Price chatter telephone that we all either had when we were kids or knew somebody who had. We thought it would be a perfect person to be that character.
And Michael, what did you get from watching all the Prison Break movies?
Well, I mean, this is the tragedy of screenwriting is that you always have like 1,000 ideas, basically, and then you have room for maybe 8 of them to go in the final film. I mean, we had a whole sequence. You know, in a lot of prison films, you show the preparations that everyone does for escape. Like you show them stealing stuff and you show them, you know, laying away stuff. And we actually had a whole sequence like that in the film. We had a whole sequence where they go steal the bag of marbles and they go steal the tortilla and they go, you know, get everything ready and prepared. And then we just ended up cutting that whole scene out because it just slowed the film down. It didn't really lead anywhere.
And it was kind of more fun to watch them to watch the plan unfold when we didn't even know what the plan was ourselves. I wish I could have all those hours of my life back that we banged our heads against the table trying to come up with ways for them to break out of prison.
Toy Story 3 director Lee Unkrich and screenwriter Michael Arndt speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2010 interview with Lee Unkrich and Michael Arndt, the director and screenwriter of Toy Story 3. It's up for 5 Oscars, including Best Picture. Here's another scene from early in the film. Andy is preparing to leave home for college. His mother orders him to clean out the stuff in his room as Andy's childhood toys listen in horror.
Okay, Andy, let's get to work here. Anything you're not taking to college either goes in the attic or it's trash.
Mom, I'm not leaving till Friday.
Come on, it's garbage day.
Mom.
Look, it's simple. Skateboard, college. Little League trophy, probably attic. Apple core, trash. You can do the rest.
Why do you still have these toys?
Molly, out of my room.
3 more days and it's mine.
Molly, you're not off the hook either. You have more toys than you know what to do with. Some of them could make other kids really happy.
What kids?
The children at the daycare. They're always asking for donations.
What's daycare?
Shh,
no buts. You choose the toys you want to donate. I'll drop them off at Sunnyside.
Poor Barbie.
I get the Corvette.
Andy, come on. You need to start making decisions.
Like what?
Like, what are you going to do with these toys? Should we donate them to Sunnyside?
No.
Maybe sell them online?
Mom, no one's going to want those old toys. They're junk.
Fine. You have till Friday. Anything that's not packed for college or in the attic is getting thrown out.
Whatever you say, Mom.
Lee, you have a story from your own life about accidentally throwing out toys. Would you tell that story?
Years ago, my wife, Laura, and I were moving from one apartment to another and packing everything up. And about a month after we moved to our new place, Laura asked me if I'd seen her beloved stuffed animals, her childhood stuffed animals. And I said, what box were they in? And she said, well, they weren't in a box. They were in a garbage bag. And my blood instantly ran ice cold because I realized exactly what had happened. I had thrown all of her stuffed animals away in the dumpster behind our building. So I feel terrible to this day that that happened. But I do hope that by immortalizing that moment in the movie that that they somehow have been immortalized themselves.
So did you come up with the premise of Toy Story 3 because of this story that we just heard, Lee, of you accidentally throwing out your wife's stuffed animals?
No, that kind of came later. I mean, truly, the very beginning of this was, we had wanted to make a Toy Story 3 for years, ever since Toy Story 2. And unfortunately, there were a bunch of kind of boring contractual problems between Disney and Pixar at the time that prevented us from making a Toy Story 3. And that went on for years. And then finally, just over 4 years ago, Disney bought Pixar Animation Studios. We became a part of Disney, and those problems went away, and we were finally freed up to make a Toy Story 3. So at that point, John Lasseter asked me to direct the film, and we then subsequently went off on a retreat. John and Andrew Stanton, who I know you've spoken to, and Pete Docter, and we talked long and hard about what we wanted Toy Story 3 to be. And we're all in agreement right from the beginning that we didn't want Toy Story 3 to feel like an arbitrary, grafted-on sequel. I always had in my mind the movie The Bad News Bears Go to Japan as a model of what we didn't want to do. We didn't want to make the film unless we felt like we really had something to say. And ultimately, the most important thing for us was that we wanted to treat this third film like kind of the completion of a saga, like as if we had been telling one grand story over the course of the three films. So we looked at it in that way, and what we arrived at pretty quickly was that it was vital to have Andy grown up and be at that transition where the toys were on the cusp of no longer being needed or wanted or loved, and that just seemed like the perfect setting for the story.
So are there ways that you started to examine the world differently, knowing that you were writing from the point of view of toys? And, you know, that you were not only writing from the point of view of a child, but from, like, stuffed animals and, a wooden cowboy and a plastic Tyrannosaurus Rex. Mike, let me ask you, because you're newer to this.
When we are in a story meeting, we're trying to figure this stuff out. We usually go to the human analog. Like, we usually, we don't talk about, if I were a rag doll or, if I were a plastic dinosaur. We start talking about you because you want to get to the emotional truth of this story, and you want to get to the emotional truth of these characters. And so you go, okay, well, Woody is, he's a little bit like a helicopter mom. He's a little bit like a mom who can't let go of her child, And so we always try and figure out, what is the human equivalent of one of these characters.
But then the fun thing is, once we have that figured out, we then try to find ways of making their issues particularly a toy's issues. Ken was a great instance of,
This is Ken, Michael as in Ken and Barbie, yeah.
Exactly. Ken of Ken and Barbie. Michael, I don't know if you had any Ken dolls when you were growing up. I certainly didn't, but my friend's little sisters did, and we made endless fun of Ken. Ken is just a whipping boy. And
isn't in the movie, I should say, his masculinity is always being called into question.
I don't know if his masculinity to some degree, but it's more that, we thought, well, what does it feel like to be a guy who's a girl's toy? You're a guy, but you're only played with by little girls. And then further, he's just an accessory to Barbie. He doesn't carry equal weight with Barbie. He's really no more important than a pair of shoes or a belt or a purse to her. And we knew that he would have to have a complex.
Yeah, no, that's one of the things that's such a pleasure working on a film like this, is that you go, okay, well, what are going to be the issues of a character like Ken? Like, what's going to be the thing that, like, keeps him awake at night, And, immediately you come into the fact that, well, maybe he's a little bit insecure about the fact that really he's a girl's toy, and maybe he's in denial of that. And then you suddenly, this whole sort of richness opens up. And the fact that, what do Ken and Barbie do? All they do is, they sort of have their accessories and they have their clothes. So when they meet for the first time, I had to think as a writer, okay, well, what are they going to say to each other? Like, what is the thing that they're going to have in common? And of course, it's just the fact that they have all these different clothes. And so you have to think, well, these characters probably love clothes and they remember all the different collections from all the different years. And so, when they first meet, the first thing is, he compliments her on her her leg warmers, and she compliments him on his ascot, and you realize, oh my God, these were made for each other. And then when they sort of break up at the end and they are at odds with each other, what's the one thing that Barbie can do to sort of torture Ken and get some information out of him? She's going to, attack his wardrobe and start ripping them to pieces.
A lot of people report having cried at the end of Toy Story 3. And Michael, when you were writing the film, were you thinking, yeah, they'll really be tearing up at this scene? Were you thinking about that at all?
You don't think that at all. You just think, oh my God, I hope this works. I hope people like this. But I remember when I wrote the first draft, I wrote it in sequence. I wrote it chronologically. So I started off, with scene one and then scene two. And it took me about 6 weeks, maybe 6 to 8 weeks to write the first draft. And I remember, so I felt like as I was writing the story, I was experiencing it with these characters. And you see them go through all these travails and, these betrayals and all these terrible things happen to them. And through the whole story, Woody keeps insisting, no, Andy still cares about us. I know he does. It doesn't seem that way, but I know he still cares about us. And I remember getting to going to my office, sitting down to write the final scene. And I say, okay, I have to figure out what Andy's going to say when he hands over Woody. And I, these words, I just start hearing Andy's voice saying, Woody's brave like a cowboy should be and kind and smart, but the thing that makes him special is that he'll never give up on you. And as I was writing this, I couldn't help but just get all choked up, and I, had little tears coming down my eyes because I felt like I had been on that journey with those characters, that's when you know that a script is working, when you have that response as you're writing it. So, I remember just finishing the scene, and there was kind of an odd moment where I finished it, and then I sort of walked out, of the door of my office to take a break, and everybody was just sort of going about their business as though nothing had happened. And in my own mind, there had been this huge, huge thing that had happened, that Andy had given away Woody, I felt a little silly, but I felt like you'd hit the target that you'd set up for yourself. So it's just very gratifying to see that other people end up, experiencing that scene the same way.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. It's been great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Terry. It was great to be here.
Toy Story 3 director Lee Unkrich and screenwriter Michael Arndt speaking to Terry Gross last year. Their movie is up for 5 Oscars, including Best Picture. And it's the highest-grossing film in that category. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Kaboom. This is Fresh Air. With his breakout films The Living End and The Doom Generation in the early 90s and Mysterious Skin in 2005, director Greg Araki became a leading figure in gay independent cinema. His new comedy, Kaboom, features college students with a somewhat fluid sexuality. Kaboom is now playing in New York and L.A. and also is available as a pay-per-view feature on IFC On Demand. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Kaboom is a freewheeling sex comedy with the punch of a graphic novel and a glow that's positively unearthly. The reds, blues, and violets are radiant, verging on radioactive, while the buildings on the college campus where it's set loom like giant spaceships against the night sky. The sex, of which there's a lot, is central to how writer-director Greg Araki's characters orient themselves to the world. That's orient in all senses. 18-year-old Smith, played by Thomas Decker, declares his sexual orientation to be, quote, undeclared. He leans gay, but when women throw themselves at him, he's magically open, eager for new discoveries. He's a gorgeous, dreamy-eyed young man with a super hot blonde lesbian best friend, Stella, played by Haley Bennett, who's hilariously blasé and wears short shorts with clear plastic thigh-high boots. And when they sit on the grass and share notes on their lovers, their platonic vibe is hot, hot, hot. With all its eye candy and over-the-top innuendo, Kaboom is borderline camp, but I'm happy to say that it never spills over. For starters, camp was created to satirize so-called heterosexual normalcy, whereas what's normal here is fluid, undeclared. The movie doesn't have any straights to parody. The characters' emotions are pure, their libidos purer. Smith can barely contain himself around his shaggy blonde roommate, whose name is Thor, and he's equally smitten by Thor's friend, Rex. But he's also drawn to a madcap British femme called London, played by Juno Temple, first seen in a red cone hat and fluffy lavender shawl. She summons Rex to their cafeteria table while Smith cringes in embarrassment.
Hey.
Rex, this is my friend London. London, Rex.
You look lonesome. You want some company?
Sure, thanks.
We were just talking about sex.
She's kidding.
So, Rex, you ever heard of the Kinsey scale?
Huh?
It's a rating system for sexual orientation, with zero being totally hetero and six 100% gay. Smith here is probably a 3 or 4, while I'm more like a 1.5.
Why don't we talk about something else?
Kinsey discovered that only 5 to 10% of the population are a 6 or a 0. What do you think your number is?
0, I guess.
Boring.
Dr. Kinsey would have a stroke watching Kaboom, but I bet he'd die happy. Yet that title is meant to suggest both orgasm and apocalypse. From the start of the film, there's an aura of dread. Smith is having bizarre and ominous dreams about what will happen on his 19th birthday. And while he's falling in and out of beds, he's stalked by men in masks of tigers and apes. Did he witness the murder of a red-haired woman, or was it a hallucination? It's gradually clear that the world awaiting the young and sexually liberated isn't so pretty. With Kaboom, Greg Araki has outdone himself, which is saying a lot. From the early 90s and his satirical AIDS fantasia, The Living End, he's turned pop culture inside out to explore his generation's collective unconscious. In his 2005 Mysterious Skin, he burrowed into the heads of child sex abuse victims, into their mystical visions and horror of their bodies. Then he turned around and made the stoner comedy Smiley Face, which shouldn't have bombed. I liked its uninhibited silliness and loved Anna Faris as the unemployed actress who accidentally eats a batch of pot cupcakes and drops the last surviving original manuscript of the Communist Manifesto from a Ferris wheel. Smiley Face's loony cartoon style clearly loosened Araki up, and the mixture of tones and Kaboom is exhilarating, part Blake Edwards, part David Lynch. As Smith explores his sexuality, the Lynch-like riddles of his childhood return with a vengeance. He tries to get answers from his highly sexed mom, played by Kelly Lynch, about the dad he was told died in a car accident. Somehow, because of what happened before Smith was born, the fate of the world now hangs by a thread. I suspect that, on some crazy level, today's college freshmen, with their adventurous, unfettered sexuality and end-of-civilization anxieties, will be able to relate. Kaboom could be their anthem.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Herzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition. On the web at metlife.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, a car-crashing, plane-jumping, bone-breaking, death-defying Hollywood life. Stuntman Hal Needham tells us how he almost died during one risky scene.
Next thing I knew, I was upside down, going backwards across a desert floor about 30 feet in the air, and I said, boy, there's going to be some kind of wreck here any moment.
Hal Needham's new memoir is called Stuntman. Join us.